Welcome to Tardi Macha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Tzivi Zuckerman, and today we will be studying Malachim Bet, Perek Yud Bet, Chapter 12. In the last parak, we discussed the Royal Reset, Malchut Yehuda edition. The story of the Reset continues in this parak, which focuses on Yehoash's reign and his major life project, the Bedek HaBayit, the repair and renovation of the Beit HaMikdash. However, before I describe the details of this major reconstruction project and describe the course of Yehoash's reign, let's revisit our discussion about the role of Malchut Yehuda in the larger destiny of the Jewish people, in order to understand what hangs in the balance in this opportunity for Malchut Yehuda to make a fresh start. We explained at an earlier point that once the two Jewish kingdoms failed to reunite during the reign of Asa Melech Yehuda, the fulfillment of the mission of the Jewish people became centered in Malchut Yehuda, the hereditary dynasty of David HaMelech. This mission was the creation of a just and compassionate society totally dedicated to God. The mission was derailed by the intermarriage of Malchut Yehuda into the evil Beit Achav, which introduced spiritual disease into the Davidic dynasty. Now that the vestiges of Beit Achav have been cleansed from Malchut Yehuda through the efforts of Yehu and Atalia's murders as well, Malchut Beit David can start afresh. In this fresh start for Malchut Yehuda, we will refocus on our three themes for Sefer Malachim, which we mentioned at the start of the Sefer. They are, 1, the role of the king, whose job it is to lead the people to God. 2, the challenge of the king, which is the king's inner conflict of gaiva, kochi va'utzim yadi, and self-aggrandizement, versus humility and an awareness of dependence on God. And 3 is the outcome of the king's choices within the divine system of human accountability, schar va'onesh. The events that we see in Sefer Malachim are the outcomes of the king's behavior. They follow directly from the king's ability, or alternatively his failure, to recognize God and lead the people to him. In our parak, with Yehoash making a clean start, the questions will be, will Yehoash be able to accomplish this goal? Will he serve God with all of his heart? And will he lead the people to God? The litmus test for the king's behavior, as always, will center around the trait of gaiva, arrogance, versus anava, humility. Sometimes the struggle with gaiva will express itself as an allergy, so to speak, toward a feeling of dependence. When someone has given you a gift or done a big favor for you, it comes along with a feeling of dependence, which our conscience recognizes and directs us toward a feeling of gratitude. However, this feeling of dependence can be uncomfortable. Our ego prefers to feel strong and independent. There's a fascinating phenomenon of the human psyche, and that is the internal and largely subconscious conflict that can arise when someone is the beneficiary of another's kindness. The conscience knows the debt of gratitude must be repaid, but the ego rebels against feeling indebted to anyone for anything. Neither the conscience nor the ego want to give way, but since a human being can't live with this type of conflict and the inner turmoil that comes with it, he resolves it by rewriting his narrative of reality. He tells himself that his supposed benefactor is actually his enemy, who seeks to harm rather than help him. This grotesque distortion of reality, actually a complete inversion of it, makes the conflict disappear and gives him the inner peace he craves. My father, Rabbi Eitan Kobri, explains in his Sefer Matami Mordechai that this inversion of reality is the basis for the phrase kafoi tov, referring to someone who is ungrateful. The word kefia, or kofeh, is used by Chazal in various places to refer to turning something on its head, such as turning a bowl upside down. Kfias tov, then, means inverting the good someone else has done for me and claiming that instead he has harmed me. For the egocentric individual, there is a sort of psychological compulsion to invert reality, since allowing reality to stand as it really is would perpetuate the ongoing contradiction between what his conscience knows and what his ego is willing to allow. We will see that the story of Yehoash is a classic story of kafoi tov. Yehoash has every reason to feel dependent and grateful to his mentor Yehoyada HaKohen. As we saw in the last parak, Yehoyada saved his life, protected him, orchestrated the recovery of his throne, and mentored him for the duration of his life. We'll see toward the end of the story of Yehoash's life that Yehoash responds to all that Yehoyada did for him with kafoi tov. The Perek begins with an introduction to Yehoash and an assessment of his reign. We're told in Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, that Yehoash did what was good in God's eyes all the days of his mentor Yehoyada. The only caveat, as we are told in Pasuk Daled, verse 4, is that the bamot, the private altars, which were permissible at times before the building of the Beit HaMikdash, but by this time were forbidden, according to Jewish law, persisted in Malchut Yehuda. The people continued to sacrifice to God on these altars. The next section of the chapter, verses 5 through 17, focuses on a description of the Bedek HaBayit, a major construction project focused on repairing and renovating the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash needed to be repaired, says Radak, because Atalia had breached the walls of the Beit HaMikdash and damaged it in other ways as well. She had also looted the temple treasury for the temples of her idols. Now, if we only read the account of Yehoshua's life in Malachim, we would be left with the impression that he was an entirely good king, since the Navi tells us that he did what was good in Hashem's eyes. However, if he was an entirely good king, then in line with the theme of Schar Va'onash, we would guess that as reward for Yehoash, the times were peaceful. However, toward the end of our parak, two events are mentioned that seem out of step with this positive evaluation of Yehoash. Firstly, Pasuk Yirchet, verse 18, describes an attack of Chazael on Malchut Yehuda. The second event, which seems out of place, is in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, verse 21, where Yehoash is assassinated by his own courtiers. If Yehoash is a good king, why are bad things happening to him? What are we missing here? As we've seen in the past, Divrei Hayyamim Bet tells the same story that we find in Malachim, but often fills in details that are missing in Malachim. It's beyond our scope here to discuss why and how the two books approach things differently. Apparently, however, things were not as smooth as they appear from the text of Malachim. Divrei Hayyamim tells us in chapter 24 that specifically after the death of Yehoyada, the Sari Yehuda, the nobles of Yehuda, came to Yehoash and said to him, according to the Medrash Tanchuma, "You lived for 6 years in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies. That's a place where no man, other than the Kohen Gadol and Yom Kippur, can enter and come out alive. You must be some sort of god." They deified Yehoash and began to engage in other idolatrous practices as well. It's unclear whether Yehoash agreed to this or simply didn't protest. Hashem sent the Navi Zechariah, the son of Yehoyada, to rebuke the people for their sins. The people didn't take to this too well, and they angrily stoned Zechariah in the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash, either on the word of the king or possibly without his protesting this horrific act. This is a shocking development, especially considering who Zechariah was as the son of Yehoyada. The Midah of Kafoy Tov is very striking here. Yehoash kills, or allows the murder, of the son of the man who saved his life, put him on the throne, and guided and educated him. One of the kinos of Tisha B'Av, based on Kohelet Rabbah, tells us that Zechariah's blood continued to seethe on the floor of the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash for 250 years. No attempt to hide the deed was successful, and it remained there until the time of the Chorban Beit HaMikdash. What was the process that led Yehoash from a point of so much hope and potential, poised to reset Malchut Yehuda on a positive spiritual path, to an end so warped with selfishness and self-justification? Rav Yigal Ariel, in his Sefer Mikdash Melech, explains that there are hints in the text that Yehoash was chafing at his dependence and indebtedness toward Yehoyada. We see a glimmer of this issue when in Pasuk Chet, verse 8, we see Yehoash criticizing Yehoyada, his mentor, and the other Kohanim for the way they were dealing with the Bedek HaBayit, the temple renovation. After the death of his mentor Yehoyada, Yehoash is more than willing to give up this unwanted sense of dependence in exchange for fawning advisors who idolize him, quite literally. In suggesting that there was something godly in Yehoash surviving his stay in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, these advisors took an episode that in truth was an enormous chesed Hashem and involved huge mesirat nefesh on the part of Yehoyada and his wife Yehosheva, and they mythologized it. They crafted a story that placed Yehoash as a powerful, godly player in the very circumstance where he was really the dependent recipient of abundant goodness. Once Yehoash shifted to seeing himself at the center of the universe, he was unable to see Yehoyada's, or Hashem's, chesed, since if he's at the center of the universe, if he is the source of his own salvation, then everything's coming to him. It's only a short step from there to complete Kfirat Tov, an inversion of reality that repays good with evil, condoning the murder of his own benefactor's son. We will now see in the concluding details of Yehoash's story how the Schar Va'onesh plays out both on the national level and on a personal level. We see Schar Va'onesh playing out on the national level with the attack of Chazal of Aram on Yehuda. The story Malachim highlights that Yehoash was forced to bribe Chazal to back off, giving away all the valuables of the Beit HaMikdash. In a striking irony, Yehoash's major life project as king, the restoration of the Beit HaMikdash, is completely undone. The Schar Va'onesh plays out on a personal level as well. Yehoash was killed by two of his courtiers who were angry about the murder of Zechariah. In Divrei Hayamim, we are told that the assassins are children of female converts who hail originally from the nations of Ammon and Moab, the prototypical Kfuyei Tov. Avraham had given Lot everything he had, and later on in history, Lot's descendants, Ammon and Moab, refused to provide Avram's descendants, the Jewish people, with food in the Midbar, and even hired Bilam to curse them. This trait of Kfiat Tov is a fatal flaw in a king like Yehoash, especially when we consider his role in Jewish history. Yehoash was miraculously saved from death so that Malchut Beit David could continue. The destiny of the Jewish people was vested in him. In order to fill that role, he would need to embody the central trait of a Jewish king, that of Anava. However, someone who does not have the humility to show gratitude, and is even Kafoy Tov toward his greatest benefactor, is certainly fundamentally lacking in this trait of Anava. Although Yehoash did good things during his reign, he did not succeed in his calling of actualizing the mission of Malchut Beit David. The tangible symbol of his failing was Zechariah's blood, which remained there to haunt each subsequent king until the Chorban Beit HaMikdash. None of them managed to eradicate from themselves the profound failings which were symbolized by the blood, or lift themselves to a level where a new start could be made. In the long view of history, the miraculous salvation of Yehoash and his subsequent crowning as king were accompanied by so much hope, but tragically, things ended badly. In failing to fulfill his unique mission, Yehoash's actions led, in the long term, to destruction and exile. Yehoash's struggle, this desire for independence, is something that most of us can relate to. Most people don't like to feel indebted and dependent. However, if we're honest, we'll recognize that we are all very much indebted to so many people in our lives. If we're brave enough to stay in that vulnerable feeling of indebtedness long enough to express gratitude to those around us, we can enrich our own lives and enhance our ability to connect with others. Thank you for studying together. Le'iloi Nishmas Frida Bat Moshe Eliyahu.